He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31.
Our next person to interview is Colonel Joe Schweitzer. 1983 to 2006, he was an officer in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He was command of soldiers at the company, battalion, and brigade level to include in combat. Other assignments he had included assistant professor at the United States Military Academy, a NATO plan officer during combat operations in Kosovo, and he was also a maneuver support center chief of operations and headquarter, USACE, colonel retired. And I met Joe this last year, and he agreed to do these interviews. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our series really on veterans, the issue of warfare, how it's transitioned from muskets a long time ago to very, very sophisticated equipment today. And today we're interviewing Colonel Joe Schweitzer, and he and I met here in the Seattle area, Olympia area, and Joe was very instrumental in with his group of soldiers in both Desert Shield and Desert Storm, probably about as opposite of environments as you could possibly have between jungles of Vietnam and the canopy above everything, as well as the difference between Iraq, Iran, that area with nothing but sand piles for a long, long ways. Is that correct, Joe?
Yes. Varied environment, but we can get into it as we continue on with our discussion.
Sure. And let's, we did talk in our previous interviews about Desert Shield and Desert Storm, but just talk a little bit kind of how they evolved and how they tied together.
So we'll look at, first Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and then we can talk about the kind of the history of warfare, and how it's evolved. But, first of all, Iraq invades Kuwait on 2 August, and by 3 August, Desert Shield started, and my younger brother, Marty, was a company commander in Charlie Company 2504, 82nd Airborne Division, and the 82nd deploys as boots on the ground by 3 August, and that was really the start of Desert Shield. We started to move other air assets in place. The U.S. Air Force that was already in the region provided some cover, but basically a line in the sand was drawn between Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. And the purpose, it was clear that Iraq was the fourth largest army. There wasn't enough assets to, if Iraq wanted to invade Saudi, there wasn't enough assets on the ground or in the air, perhaps to prevent them from doing so, but the thought of Iraq going into Saudi Arabia and creating a war with the United States wasn't in their mindset. And so having a very vulnerable 82nd Airborne on the ground with limited air cover, was really the line in the sand and the threat to Iraq to go no further. And what it did is it created time and allowed for the U.S. and its coalition. Remember, this was done under a U.N. mandate.
Right.
To gather the, you know, the ground and air assets and to begin to set the theater. So we went from 3 August, the start of Desert Shield, to 16 January, the end of Desert Shield and the start of Desert Storm. And 16 January was the start of air combat operations. There was no ground combat at that time. That didn't begin until the 24th. But Desert Shield really set the theater. That was 3 August to 16 January, and then 16 January to 28 February was Desert Storm. And the first part of that were air operations to air combat operations to take out their radar, gain complete mastery of the sky, of the air, you know, to take down their air force and to take down all of their eyes and ability to detect what we were getting ready to do on the ground, and that was the start of ground operations on the 24th. And because the air campaign was so successful, and because of our leadership, the plans and the capability of our soldiers, the ground combat went very quickly, less than 100 hours, and a treaty was signed, you know, by Saddam Hussein and General Schwarzkopf on the 28th of February, and that concluded Desert Shield and Desert Storm.
And does that involve the all the Americans? You know, you see the miles and miles of military equipment and people moving back into Iraq. Does that time and also the American forces, you know, attacking that group so that they couldn't fight again. That was part of that time too, correct?
Yes. So, I mean, my company, Delta Company, 12th Engineer Battalion, the Divisional Engineer Battalion of the 8th Infantry Division, based in Germany. And the 8th Infantry Division didn't deploy, but they plucked some assets out. The Combat Engineer Battalion was one of them. And we deployed, and so after the cessation of hostilities on the 28th, you know, we were no longer actively involved in combat operations. We left theater, so from February, the end of February, all of the month of March, and I forget exactly when we redeployed, March, April, May timeframe, but we ended up, you know, basically destroying all of the equipment that the Iraqi army had abandoned on the desert floor. And there were thousands of artillery pieces and tanks and military vehicles and, you know, perhaps millions of tons of stockpiled ordnance that we destroyed. So we took all of our, you know, our tools of warfare, C4, TNT, all of our mines, our mine-clearing mine charges, we pulled out of our Miklicks, which was this 1,400 pounds of explosives on a wire cable that was used to create a path in the minefield. We would stock up all the ordnance, you know, tons of it, and then take a Miklick charge and you know, wrap it across the explosive end in the motor of the 122-millimeter rocket. And we would detonate and allow for the sympathetic detonation to destroy all the munitions. So,
hey,
yeah, that was our... Go ahead.
I was just saying, you were saying that that Miklick was... they were like ribbons of explosives that went out on both sides of a vehicle, and then they created a safe path for the vehicle to go through because they had exploded all of the landmines. Is that correct?
So our MCLIC was used, and what we did is we had a bridge vehicle called the Armored Vehicle Launch Bridge, ABLB. And because we didn't have real gaps to cross, there were dry riverbeds called wadis in the Middle East. We didn't have rivers or, you know, gaps that we had to cross. We left our bridges, we either left them somewhere in Saudi or we didn't even take them with us. And what we did is we put on top of our ABLBs, we put two MCLIC charges. And a single charge, it was 100 meters explosives, but there was a rocket. So it would launch out about 120 meters or so, 115 meters or so. On 100 meters of that cable was basically bundles, I think it was C3, bundles of explosives, and you would detonate it from inside the vehicle. And you were danger close, so you had to be buttoned up when you detonated it. And the fact is, you know, this is one of the things we did. We had about 30 days prior to going into combat, you know, 30 days of getting our equipment off boats, getting out in the middle of the desert floor and training with our armor task force, Task Force 467 Armor, the Bandits out of 3rd Armor Division. And I asked our task force commander, because we hadn't done live explosives training, like with the MCLIC. We had never fired a live one. Every time we did a Graf Hohenfels rotation, we were only allowed to fire a practice round. And I think we only were able to fire one when we were in training. But my soldiers had never experienced, you know, 1,400 pounds of explosives about 40 meters or so away from you. They had never experienced that. So I asked my task force commander allow all my ABLM tank drivers and crewmen, was a two-man vehicle, to practice and experience what it was like. So we did that. We did a lot of live fire training. We've done a lot of that in Graf Hohenfels back in Germany. And then we trained with live mines, something we weren't able to do either because of the training restrictions in Germany. But we trained with live mines to give my soldiers confidence, to take them from the inert tools of war that we used in training and get live fire experience in preparation for combat.
Now, the mines that were there, I mean, I think when most of us think of a mine, you know, we think of, this round disc in the ground, and it's got a little piece of metal, and you step on it, and it detonates the mine. But these mines were much more powerful if they were, destroying vehicles, correct?
Yeah, we have, in our inventory, we have both anti-personnel and anti-vehicle mines, and I forget all the nomenclatures of my mines.
Right.
But, you know, we have a variety of anti-personnel, and our mine warfare has gotten a lot smarter since I left the Army in 2006, since I retired. But, and we carried with us, we never deployed any mines in combat during Desert Storm. What we ended up, and we didn't have a need to, and if we were to do it, the kind of conditions that would have, you know, demanded the need to lay mines would be in the event that we had to protect our flanks and create counter mobility for the enemy, you know, not allow the enemy to maneuver on our flanks. But the speed of our offensive warfare went so fast, there was no need to counter and protect our flanks. So we never deployed any, but we did use them. We used every bit of our explosive munitions to destroy thousands of vehicles on the desert floor afterwards. But mine warfare, you know, is is controversial. I think rightfully so. I've
sure.
never been a big fan of employing mines in combat. I think, you know, from my reading of history, we had more soldiers wounded and killed in Vietnam from our own mines than we did from, you know, than we did killing the enemy from our, you know, wounding the enemy from our mines.
Right.
Mines are tricky. But like I said, a lot has happened since then. We have much smarter mines that are able to detect, you know, and determine either controlled by person or by, you know, their computer, you know, operating
right.
system.
Right.
They determine when to employ.
Well, I know, like, right now, I mean, we interviewed a woman who works with an organization in Vietnam. They actually hire Vietnamese to go out with metal detectors and those kinds of things, and that there are still literally thousands and thousands of undetonated mines in Vietnam that... you know, need to be discovered because there is no real pattern of them, and you know, people are still they're still active, and you know, people, kids are still stepping on them out there, and so I agree with you. You know, it's like after you set mines down, you know the landscape changes and everything, and it's. You want to get rid of them and not have to use them if you don't absolutely have to. But,
yeah, this is a worldwide problem. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, because I've spent time cleaning up minefields. You know, you look in, you know, even World War I, although mines are not the issue, but there are large parts of the battlefields in World War I in Europe that are off limits to personnel because of unexploded ordnance. But you look in the Balkans, you know, the mines still an issue. Vietnam still an issue. The conflict and many conflicts in Africa, you know, for me personally, Eritrea and Ethiopia, you know, were at war for 30 years and a few wars afterwards. But, you know, the amount of mines that are still on the battlefield and causing havoc to farmers, children, and the such. And UXOs is an extension of that. UXOs are unexploded ordnance. And that was, you know, one of the killers of American soldiers, our own unexploded ordnance in Desert Storm. I remember getting off my track, my M113, during combat operations, and you'd climb up out of your hatch and then you'd basically slide down the front slope of your 113. And I remember dropping on the ground, and between my legs was, it looked like a D-sized, you know, battery. It was about that big, and it had a little white tail on it. And I thought to myself, what is this? This is odd. Because I didn't have any time, you know, curiosity, you might pick something up. I didn't have any time. And I went to the talk and later learned that was a DPICM, dual purpose, something conventional munition. And it was a scatter weapon, but it was intended to explode and create fragmentation and take out personnel in a large area. This one didn't explode. We had a lot of unexploded ordnance because the age of our ordnance, a lot of this ordnance that we were using were, you know, from Korea, Vietnam. We had a lot of bomblet issues. And that was one of the things we did in our task force, to protect our task force. Because after soldiers were wounded and killed from our own unexploded munitions, we have like a bomblet unit, and I think it comes in like three different sizes, a golf ball, a baseball, a softball. It's a little green orb, and they were intended to, again, you know, take out people, take out vehicles in a large area. And the unexploded ones. You know, soldiers are curious creatures. They pick it up, and in some cases it then detonated and killed our soldiers. So we would clean up a lot of the UXOs in our task force to help protect our task force.
Well, what? Let's talk a little bit about that transition from Desert Shield to Desert Storm, where it sounds like Desert Shield was that line in the sand, but Desert Storm was, let's go and get this taken care of, I guess, for lack of better words.
Yeah, and Desert Shield started with the air campaign 16 January, and then what we did, and my task force, and we were part of, you know, that left hook. So we were out in the desert floor with hundreds of thousands of ground forces. And we were in, I think it was Wadi El Batin, a very large dry riverbed that we could basically hide our armor task force, which was comprised of hundreds of vehicles. And we then, on the 24th of February, it was literally a berm was built between that defined the Kuwait-Saudi border. And that was that berm, you know, we cut breaches into that berm. The berm was maybe 10 feet high or so. We cut breaches into that berm. And I remember our division band, the 3rd Armored Division Band, was at the berm playing, I think it was Valkyrie. You know, the division band was out there and, you know, sending us off in classic armor tradition. We then launched, and, you know, as soon as that was called the line of departure, as soon as you crossed the line of departure, you were in combat operations. And, you know, anything in front of you that was enemy was a threat, and you could fire. Our rules of engagement were pretty simple. You know, we just basically followed the Geneva Convention. If a soldier gave himself up, and they did, the enemy, you know, after about the first day, you know, with the lethality of, you know, the armor, ground forces and artillery and ATACMS, and which was a very capable, very accurate rocket part of our artillery, you know, they started to give up. I mean, the Iraqi army, after about day one, day two, unfolded pretty quickly and started to give up. And our effort was to chase you know, certain armor forces within the Iraqi army, the Republican Guard forces. They were the most capable and most lethal of the Iraqi army. But they either fled or were killed on the battlefield by this very large formation that was a part of the left hook.
Wow, that's a... And then, and Desert Storm, how long did Desert Storm last?
You know, the ground... 16 January, air and ground, 16 January to 28 February, and the ground portion of it was less than 100 hours. We, you know, crossed that berm, the line of departure, on the 24th of February, and this peace treaty, whatever it was called, was signed on the 28th of February. So it went very, very quickly.
It's, you know, it's... It sounds like it was pretty classic. I mean, you, like you said, and pretty intelligent. I mean, you go in and you destroy radar and communications, and you no longer, Iraq no longer has a cohesive force. They can't direct people from a singular location. It's kind of every man for themselves. That once that communication is destroyed, is that correct?
You know, we fought, yes, we fought using, you know, the air, land, battle doctrine, which was born out of World War II. And it was born out of one of the things my dad did when he was a captain at Fort Knox. You know, his job was to interview German generals from World War II and learn the tactics of the Blitzkrieg, lightning warfare. And, you know, General Starry and others in the 70s, we created this doctrine, the Airland Battle Doctrine, that we were going to use against the Soviets should the Soviets cross, you know, the east-west German border and attack Europe. And so that's basically the doctrine that we used in Desert Storm. And it was, you know, large force on large force maneuvering, you know, in the open desert. And so what Airland Battle Doctrine, you know, speaks to is, you know, you wanna outgun your enemy. And so you want to, first of all, take mastery of the skies. And for the Air Force to do that, it has to take down all the surface-to-air missile systems and has to take down the enemy's air capability, jets and such. And so, and then once you have mastery of the sky, you can maneuver more easily. And so you fight in depth. And our ATACMS, current ATACMS, I think has a range of about 400 kilometers. It's a very accurate rocket system, rocket artillery system. And then, you know, our 8-inch, you know, our ground artillery would then, you know, start taking out targets maybe 30 kilometers out. And then our tanks can, you know, at night detect and kill another enemy tank, you know, 2 kilometers out. Mm-hmm. And all of these systems that we have are outside the range of the enemy, like system.
Well, it would seem, too, that, you know, you would certainly reduce a lot of deaths and injuries once you, you know, have control of the air, because it's not, at that point, you know, a face-to-face kind of combat. It's you're pretty far away. So that's kind of makes sense to me. I mean, it's, and we can talk about this in our second to our next episode. But in that episode, let's talk a little bit about the evolving development of new weapons. Of course, that's the thing. You know, you always want a better weapon than the other guy. You know, my weapon is better than yours, philosophy. But I mean, that was that is the way it goes. So let's close this one up. We'll have and thank you, everyone, for listening.